Hey there, welcome to I Love You Man, the podcast that's all about fostering positive psychology and well-being in men. I'm your host, Stephen Feeney, and I'm thrilled to embark on this journey with you. In a world where conversations about mental health are becoming increasingly important, this podcast aims to create a safe space where we can openly explore, discuss, and celebrate the various aspects of male well-being. I Love You Man is a project that aims to promote positive masculinity, and I believe that this can only be borne out by shedding light on the unique challenges men face when it comes to their mental well-being. Pressures related to work, income, isolation, relationships, and physical health are afflicting men across the world today. But here's the thing, it's okay to not have it all figured out. Let's open the door and get that conversation started. Over each episode of I Love You Man, I'm going to introduce you to some positive psychology strategies which I believe can motivate, cultivate, and help you appreciate the inherent gifts within each of you. I'm a true believer that positive masculinity can make the world a better place, and that there is no better place to start than here, with you, my friend. We are going to be joined by inspiring guests from a variety of different backgrounds and discuss the role well-being plays in their lives. From music to meditation and running to relationships, we will deep dive into different realms of life that can be positively affected by small changes. Let's embrace vulnerability and build a community that promotes positivity one episode at a time. And whatever you're here for, just remember, I love you, man. Before we continue the podcast, I wish to alert listeners that topics of bereavement, suicide, and depression are all discussed with today's guest. Once again, I will put details of support groups in the episode notes and include them on my Instagram at @the_flourishingman. You are never alone, so please seek support if you need it. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Dean Arrowsmith to explore his extraordinary journey. Dean's story is one of resilience, compassion, and dedication that has brought him from Dundalk to Chicago via the beautiful county of Cavan, where he lives with his wife, Emily, and their daughter, Fia. For the past 17 years, Dean has been deeply immersed in the world of professional soccer, starting off with Dundalk FC as a community coach and kitman, which has evolved into his current role as manager of soccer in the community for Chicago Fire FC in Major League Soccer in the United States. With a UEFA A license under his belt and a passion for nurturing talent, Dean's impact on the soccer community is profound and far-reaching. Dean, thank you so much for joining me on the I Love You Man podcast today. We have a wide range of topics to touch upon, but I think it'd be great for our listeners to hear about your soccer journey. How does a man from the northeast of Ireland end up in one of the biggest cities in the United States involved in the soccer community over there?
First of all, thanks very much for having me, Stephen. And I hope everyone that's listening doesn't make fun of the hybrid Dundalk, Cavan, Chicago accent that might come out at different points of the conversation. But I'm delighted to be here. Delighted to be on your podcast. I listened to the first episode with Frank and I thought it was amazing. So moving into kind of my career, so as you said, I was born in Dundalk. I'd love to say I was raised there, but unfortunately, at a young age, we got moved down to Coothill and Cavan. My dad was one of the founder members of Coothill Harps Football Club in Cavan, and he's still heavily involved in that to this day. And I just kind of grew up on the sidelines with dad. Spent a lot of time around football, obviously in a GAA stronghold of Cavan. Soccer, if you want to call it, or football wouldn't be the number one sport. So it was kind of difficult growing up at times being the son of the soccer man, you know, in a town like that. But I realized at a very, very young age, probably 16, that I wasn't going to make it as much as I loved it. Never missed training sessions, etc. Just wasn't very good at the sport. Probably didn't have the best coaches or didn't have coaches that were as well educated maybe as coaches are today. And at the age of 16, just I think it was 2 weeks or 3 weeks after my 16th birthday, I got my Kickstart 1, which is what it was called at the FEI at the time, and just loved coaching. I started coaching at the age of 17. I was coaching Coothill's under 15 team and just kind of fast-tracked through that all the way into college when I went to Dundalk Institute of Technology to study community sports leadership. And from there, got my Kickstart 2, ended up getting during the time when I was at college, I got my youth cert, which would be the equivalent of the C license nowadays, and got an opportunity to come to Chicago for 6 months. absolutely hated it till the day I was leaving. Cried when I was leaving, and I was like, it didn't. I was only 20 at the time, and just kind of fish out of water going into a big city like Chicago. Moved back home, and got asked then that Christmas time if I come in and work with Dundalk FC and help with the kit man for a week. Just as the manager at the time, Ian Foster, his wife had just gone into labour as he was flying over to take the first day of pre-season. So I got a call just to ask if I'd put down cones for a week, and I ended up staying for 3 years at the club at the time, because I'd done a little bit on the community side with them before that, and then I was the club promotion officer in 2012. But during those 2 years, I mean, was probably the best apprenticeship I could get in football. Working with Fozzie and his assistant manager in the first year, Wayne Hatswell, is actually the godfather of both my late daughter Charlie and my living daughter Fia, to this day. So just getting the opportunity to work around full-time football and being that and working with, I mean, great players like Jason Byrne, Mark Quigley. There's probably a few I'm missing out that if they're listening, they'll be complaining to me. I think actually someone from down your neck of the woods, Greg Bulger, just re-signed with Cork City. Greg would have played midfield during that time, and as I said, it was a great kind of education for me to go through that course at the time. So or sorry, to go through that time with Dundalk. 2012, as I say, I was club promotions officer. That lasted only 5 6 months because the club was going through some financial difficulties during that time. And after being let go, I think it was the end of May or the beginning of May of that year, I ended up just working in my role unpaid for the next 7 months because I love Dundalk Football Club. Anybody that sees me, whether I'm sober or drunk, it's nearly all I talk about. Now that I've got family, I'll chat about my family a little bit more. But Dundalk FC is kind of where my heart it was and still is to this day. So the ability to kind of keep doing that, and we founded a group called Save Our Club at the time, and thankfully we were able to raise money by, I think we'd done any kind of fundraiser could be done at the time, from packing bags in supermarkets to running discos and quiz nights, etc. We managed to raise money just to keep players paid, and it kept the club afloat till the end of the season, till it was taken over. I worked in another couple of jobs then in between, and then 2015 the opportunity came to come back to America, to Chicago, and I jumped at it. It was always in the back of my mind, even during the times at Dundalk. It was always in the back of my mind. I think I applied to come back every year after 2009 and just pulled out at the last minute. So came back in 2015. And since then, I've just kind of set the roots. I met in 2017, I met my wife, Emily. And I suppose the rest is history. But no, it's, as I say, it's, I love it here. Worked for a club, a youth club here for best part of 8 years, and then last year I got a phone call asking if I'd be interested in taking on the role of manager of soccer in the community for Chicago Fire. And my passion is really about community work and kind of influencing the future generation of young people. So I jumped at the opportunity, and thankfully it's 12 months in or 13 months in, it's paid off so far.
Obviously from my time there, I know Chicago is a mad sports city. Soccer isn't number one, but in terms of sport, reaching out to the communities and I suppose the communities and the difficulties that some of them face there has been very well publicized. Just tell us a little about what your role and what kind of stuff you get up to with them.
Yeah, so my role kind of varies. So essentially what I do is I manage the coaches who go out and work in the community programs in Chicago, and I would work with we work with schools, but we also then do what's known as the players program, which my coaches would be heavily involved in, and that's where we provide CPS and public schools with the opportunity to train kids for 10 weeks and then have 3 game days followed by one match day experience at one of the Chicago Fire games. And it's very similar, to be honest, it's very similar to some of the stuff that I'd done unpaid and with Dundalk Football Club back in probably 2007, 2008, while I was still in college. So there's a lot of parallels between the two clubs. I mean, I would always say Dundalk's more beautiful than Chicago, but there's always parallels between the I see them between both cities, as you said, are both sports mad, and kind of the impact, right? And you know, from someone who spent time in Chicago, there's a huge impact on if the Bears, the Cubs, the Sox, Chicago Fire, etc., if they're doing well, the town just seems to be, or the city seems to be, a little bit livelier. So my kind of role is just building that next generation of supporter of Chicago Fire and doing good things in the community that impacts them, that we can use football as the vessel kind of to positively impact, as I say, the communities and the next generation.
You must be immensely proud of yourself to emerge from Coot Hill all the way over to Chicago and have been playing such a role in such a massive organization. The MLS is obviously getting a lot of publicity at the moment because of Lionel Messi and everything like that. So, like, just tell me about the emotions behind that and, you know, your achievements to date.
Yeah, I mean, I'm probably at an age now where I do look back and reflect on it. I think when I first got into coaching, even when I was first with Dundalk, I was only 20, 21, and you feel like big time Charlie, you know what I mean? Back in those days, you're working with a professional organization. But now I look back on it, and again, my role for the most part with the Fire would go unnoticed because it's such, as you say, with the Lionel Messi stuff, like all the focus is on the first teams, you know, how the main team is going, which it should. But as I say, I came from the role that I was in previously where I probably would have impacted maybe 750 kids in the AYSO program in just outside Chicago. Now I think last year we impacted 4,500. So it's just that reach, you know what I mean? And the ability to the staff, coaches. But for me, it's not just helping the young people, it's helping the coaches that work with us too, because some of our coaches will come from those inner city areas too, and giving them opportunities that maybe wouldn't normally be afforded to them. And as I say, it's just, for me, it's all about just helping shape the world. The way it sounds really cliched, but how I want the world to be and what we can do. And I mean, I think obviously within the first 2 weeks, I think I met you on in one of the programs that we were running. So it's the opportunity to meet people as well. And as I say, if I can impact and through the work that we do, if we can impact even one child, I think that's better than anything, you know. So I love it. To answer your question, I'm very proud of where I've gotten to. It's, as I say, it can be hard work at times, but once you just kind of know what you're striving for and what your purpose is, and it just makes everything that more kind of fulfilling, and it makes the hard work worth it as well.
Absolutely fantastic. I can hear your passion for advocacy in what you're saying there when it comes to soccer, and I know you're a passionate advocate for mental health. You've been through some massive personal challenges over the last number of years. Can you just maybe talk the listeners through what were some of the pivotal moments that kind of led to you becoming such a mental health advocate?
Yeah, no problem. I suppose, look, if when I go back to my own mental health journey, people probably will listen to this and say, geez, he's very outgoing and, you know, he wants to have a bit of crack, etc. And that's true, but also I would have been someone, and again, it's probably only in the last couple of years since I got really big into the mental health advocacy that I would reflect on, even reflect back 20 years on my own life and stuff. And growing up, I would have been a very anxious child. Probably in my teenage years when I was in secondary school, I would have kind of came out of my shell a little bit. But then I went to college, as I say, in DKIT, and I was only 17. I just turned 17 when I went to college in my first year, and halfway through that year, I was involved in a very, very minor car accident where I rear-ended another car, and it wasn't anything major. But I remember that having a deep effect. I mean, I couldn't really understand why, and I ended up going to the counselling in the college. They offered free counselling at the time. I think I only went to two sessions, and that's something that I think last year was the first time, or maybe 2 years ago was the first time I ever actually brought that up. I had actually completely forgot about that time in my life, as I say. But now I'm doing quite a lot of reflection on it. So that would have been probably the first time when I look back that I was aware of my mental health and probably wanted to do something to make sure that I didn't fall into a deeper funk. And then fast forward to 2017. So that would have been 10 years later. I unfortunately lost my uncle to suicide, and I was here in Chicago. My uncle lives in Dundalk. All my family are based out of Dundalk. So, it's obviously, it's being so far away, it was difficult. Being so far away, as I say, it was very difficult to be away from family, to be away from that. And my uncle and me would have been close. I wouldn't say we were like really, really close, but I would have been close to him. I had just the previous October, so he passed away on the 27th of March, so his anniversary is coming up. But the previous October, I ran my first ever 5K, and he was an avid runner, and he would be known within running circles in Ireland as the TikTok runner. He would always count down all his races, and particularly in the Dundalk, and I think Derry, he would have been very well regarded. So, that just had a really deep impact on me. And I think 5 6 days after he passed away, I'd done the Shamrock Shuffle, which is a really big race here in Chicago every year. For me, as I say, it was a really, really tough probably 12 months, 12 to 18 months after that. After he passed away, thankfully I had my now wife at the time. We had just started dating, and I mean, you get to know someone when they're grieving. You really get to know what they're about. And I feel like, while it's not the nicest way for us to get to know each other, she learned a lot about me, and I learned a lot about her during that time. And I mean, I'd be lost without her, not just during that, but in general. And about 6 months after that, I lost my granddad. So my uncle's father passed away too. It was actually on Thanksgiving of 2017. My mom was out visiting, so my mom's dad passed away on that day. So it was just almost like anything that could go wrong was going wrong. And again, because of kind of visa issues at the time, I wasn't living out here legally, but it just with different visa issues, it would have been very difficult for me to go home for a funeral and come back out here in quick succession. So I missed two funerals during that time, which again, as I say, was extremely that was extremely tough. And since then, I've used running has been a really big help for me, and a huge help with my kind of probably something I would have in my mental health tool belt, and it's something that I do. I try to get 20 miles in a week. Ran two Chicago marathons for the American Foundation of Suicide Prevention in memory of my uncle. And even today, with some of the stuff we'll probably get into a little bit later, I continue to run because I feel like that's something that's obviously very important to me, but it's something that keeps me close to my uncle as well, because it's something that obviously he was a keen ad or had a keen interest in. So that's obviously, as I say, it's something that I make sure that we that I do, not just for me, but to kind of, as I say, to memorialize him too.
Well, I'm really sorry that you had to go through that, and thank you for sharing. I'd love to know really about, how does a family deal with the news like that? And how, because obviously, every community in Ireland now is being touched by suicide. How does the family that is so close to it sort of digest that information and process it and try to move on from it?
It's a really good question. I think for me, it's you don't. Sorry if I'm pausing, but you don't really move on from it. You just kind of move forward with it, And that's what I've said even through some of the stuff, as I say, that we'll get to later. You never, when tragedy hits, you don't move on. You don't like become yourself again. You just carry that with you all the time, and you have good days, you have bad days, and once you learn to kind of understand that, I think that's something that maybe how a family deals with it. I could tell you from my family, because over in a short space of time, within 3 years, we suffered multiple losses, but from kind of my close family, I mean, we still kind of grieve it, every day or every other day. This time of year, as I say, as we get closer to it, Uncle Andrew's anniversary, it gets difficult, So, it's just learning to kind of acknowledge it's going to get difficult. I think that's one of the biggest things that I would kind of say for anyone listening that is maybe going through something, is it's okay to have a shitty day, you know what I mean? And again, that's probably taken me. He passed away in 2017. It's probably taken me 4 or 5 years to come to terms with that a shitty day is just as okay as a great day, you know what I mean? And neither of them are invalid at that time. And I think, as I say, from our family's perspective, it's just understanding when people are having good days and having bad days, and not making a big deal out of it, in terms of you don't need to fall out with someone just because they're not feeling it today. You just have to understand that people grieve totally differently,
Yeah, I totally agree. And obviously, going through that in 2017 was super difficult. Then in 2020, the whole world was turned upside down with the pandemic, but your own world was turned upside down with a terrible personal tragedy. Do you want to just touch upon about that and tell us a bit about it?
Yeah, so there was two things happening in 2020. So going back to the Dundalk stuff, and I'll probably always keep going back to that. But Dundalk's videographer, Harry Taff, passed away by suicide in July. And the very next day, I was messaging a few people that I knew from Dundalk, and I said it's a disgrace that there was a lot of people putting out the hashtag, RIP, and mentioning Harry, which again, I don't want to invalidate anybody's feelings, but the thing that bugged me is when somebody passes away by suicide, it's sad for a day. Even when a celebrity does it, you know, it's sad for a day, and then the next day everybody just moves on, and I don't know how I feel about that. I feel really uncomfortable about that. So the day after Harry passed away, I wrote a poem called The Floodlights, which I never really write, and I wrote this poem called The Floodlights, and I shared it with a few Dundalk fans, and they said it was really good and it should go out. So I said, look, in terms of sports and football, we should probably do something to bring more awareness to positive mental health, and positive discussions like you're doing with the podcast about men's mental health in particular. But we thought it was very important from our perspective in the early days to make sure that we weren't excluding either gender when it came to the discussion. But we founded what is now known as Head in the Game, which is a mental health advocacy group, specifically around Irish football, and thankfully it's gone amazingly well. So that happened July of 2020. During that time, myself and Emily found out we were expecting our first child, and then on 20 weeks. So again, I'm flat out doing all this stuff for mental health, keeping myself busy during the pandemic. We were pregnant, everything was going well during the pregnancy, and then at 20 weeks we went in for the 20 week scan, and the doctor said to Emily was getting scanned. I couldn't obviously be in the room because of COVID at the time. I was waiting out in the hallway, but I was allowed in for the meeting with the doctor after, and the doctor just was like, yeah, everything's great, she's going through her sheets, and then at the very last sheet she's like, oh wait, hold on, there's an issue, it looks like there's a problem with the baby's left ventricle. She was like, don't, if this was on the 15th of the 15th of December, it was my mom's 60th birthday that day. She said, don't worry about it, but I would advise you to go to see a specialist within the next 7 days. And we were like, well, fuck, the next 7 days is, you know, we're getting very, very close to Christmas at that point, so it's going to be hard to get in anywhere. So we called and managed to get a booking for 2 days later on the 17th. On the 17th, we went in for an echocardiogram again. One of the biggest and best hospitals in Chicago, or in the US, Northwestern Hospital. I had to sit in the lobby, and Emily was up on the 13th floor going through this scan. And I mean, the doctor told us 2 days previous, don't look it up. And of course, when they tell you don't look something up, you check everything, you know. And we found out that she was diagnosed with hypoplastic left heart syndrome. So what that means is they're missing a part of the left, or sorry, they're missing part of the left side of their heart, which pumps, I think it's the oxygen through the body. And I could be just mistaken what exactly the function is of the left side slightly, but it wasn't good, essentially, what we were told. And there could be people listening to this today that have kids or know someone that has HLHS. I mean, I feel like myself and Emily are experts in it now, but we got given a couple of options. So one option would be we continue with the pregnancy. When Charlie, so we had already picked out a name for our daughter, Charlie May, when we found out, we could go through with the pregnancy. We would have to, Charlie would have to be put in intensive care as soon as she was born. And then if she survived 7 days, she would have to have open heart surgery. If that was successful, by the time she turns, I think it was 2 or 3, she would have to have a second open heart surgery. And then I think it was 2 or 3 years later, she would have to have a third one. And this is just to extend her life. She was never going to be able to live the normal life of a child. So that was one option we were given. The other option we were told was we could terminate the pregnancy before we got to 24 weeks. So that was, the 17th was still within that 20th week. And I mean, we weighed up all the options, and, you know, again, I don't want, people can judge, people can say however they, you know, they can think whatever they think. This is just what myself and my wife came to decide. And we made a decision that it wouldn't be fair on Charlie to have to live that life. And America's crazy, where I feel like in Ireland and other countries, they might give you a little bit more direct, like, this is what you should do for your baby. In America, because of insurance and et cetera, the doctors won't actually give you what is best for the child. They'll give you the options that are best for you. And we weighed it up, and there was parts of that day on the 17th when we went home where I was going to give up my job, and I was going to live in the hospital for the 7-8 weeks, or I think it was 7 8 weeks after Charlie was born. Emily was giving up her job, and we, as I say, we weighed up everything, and then just we came to the conclusion that every decision we were making to keep Charlie alive wasn't for Charlie. It was for us to have a daughter and for people not to think ill of any decision that we might make. But we, as I say, that evening, I burst into tears, and went into Emily, and I was like, look, I said, I don't think we can do it. And Emily was, the relief in Emily's face that I came to that conclusion, because I feel like maybe a little bit of a, she, I, there were times where I wanted to keep the pregnancy going for Emily, and I think there was a lot of times where she wanted to continue the pregnancy just for my feelings, you know. And when I came to that, I feel like she was thinking it, and I said it, and unfortunately, we, that's the conclusion that we came to. But it was a conclusion, as I said, that was made out of love for Charlie, and we wanted to make sure that she wouldn't have any, she would never experience any pain. When Emily spoke to her doctor then to confirm what decision we had made, the doctor actually said that if Charlie survived the rest of the pregnancies, because there was still another 20 weeks to go, she wouldn't have made it past day four. So she wouldn't have even made it to the first open heart surgery. That HLHS is a unique, I think there's only like 1 in 4,000 chance of a baby being diagnosed with that. And in Chicago, as I say, one of the best maternal hospitals in the US, there's only one case every 3 years, and unfortunately we were that case. But the doctor said it was the best decision for the child after we had made the decision, which again, that still hurts me a little bit to this day, that I wish the doctors could have been a little bit more honest and told us what was going on. Because where some people who, again, who are listening, who might have family that have had HLHS, they miss a chunk of their heart. Charlie had no left side of her heart at all. Like, she had like a little sliver of a left side of her heart. So it was going to be difficult for her to go out and play in a park. It was going to be difficult. She was maybe not going to go to school because of the lack of oxygen. She might have brain damage. She could have liver failure. Like, there's so much stuff could happen. And I spoke to a gentleman in the weekend between us making the decision and Emily having her procedure for Charlie. I spoke to this gentleman who, he had a son who passed away at 23 years of age, of HLHS, or all the complications with HLHS. He said if he doesn't regret the time he had with his son, but if he'd have known what his son was going to go through for 23 years earlier, he probably would have made the same decision that we made. And for me, as I say, people can judge us all they want, but that guy's comment is probably the something that sticks with me, and it will stick with me forever. Is, you know, I don't need anyone to validate that myself and Emily made the right decision. We know that we made the right decision for our daughter. We have to live with that for the rest of our lives. So as I say, that's something that we'll never move on from, that even though now we have Charlie's little sister Fee in our lives, but we'll always carry that with us, you know.
Thanks for sharing that, Dean. That's a hugely powerful and emotive story. And I can imagine that the decisions that you had to go through to reach that devastating decision couldn't be easy. And I really appreciate you, being so articulate about it. I suppose when I think of you speaking to me about that and how, my feelings generate about it, I think of you being so far away from home. And I know you talked earlier in the chat about the support that Emily gave you. Just talk about how that decision and, what the grief that you went through in that time, how you sort of evolved in your relationship and how you worked as a man supporting Emily and how, she acted as a partner to you, supporting you.
Yeah, I think, look, Emily was amazing. As the man, you go into autopilot in those situations because your partner is going through the pregnancy. They're going through all the physical and emotional pain. So as the man, like, again, as I say, we had to make the decision, and there was a 5 day period between making the decision and Charlie passing away. I took on to call a funeral home to get Charlie's ashes cremated. Like, I think if there's one message people can take from all of this, is we didn't just decide we didn't want Charlie. You know, there was never a decision we don't want Charlie's. We don't want Charlie to ever be in any pain, and thankfully we've made a decision to ensure that will never happen. But I had to call a funeral home. I had to go 2 or 3 weeks later to pick up a fetal death certificate. Like, I took some of the probably outlier things that had to be done to ensure that Emily didn't go through that stuff, because she was going through enough stuff of her own. But in terms of our relationship, I mean, something as hard as that has brought us way closer together. You know, when you go through something like that, it's as I say, it's a horrific situation, but we're so close. And I mean, I tell her all the time that, yeah, it's shit that we had to go through it, but I wouldn't want to go through that. I wouldn't want to go through anything with anybody else. You know, if I could take her pain away, I would. But the fact that, you know, we have Charlie's ashes cremated, Charlie lives in a little teddy bear, Charlie comes to Ireland with us when we go home, she travels with us on our holidays, etc. So it's not as if, as I say, that we've moved on. We incorporate Charlie into our lives together. And even with her little sister, Fia, says goodnight to Charlie every night. You know, knows who her sister is. She's only two, so she's still learning. But like, we've just made sure that our family isn't complete with just the three of us who are living. It's our family of four is complete with Charlie in it. You know.
Wow, thank you, Dean, for sharing that. It's truly inspiring to hear the resilience and fortitude your family have shown through such difficult times. Now, you talked a bit about yourself there as a bereaved father, and it's an area that we don't hear a lot about, is what men go through in these situations. And I know there's work that you continue to do in that regard. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, so kind of even as we were going through, like in that moment with the loss of Charlie, like I said to Emily, I said, we should probably look to raise some money for some support groups out here in Chicago. And we done, as I say, going back to the running and stuff that I do, we kind of do every... Charlie's due date was May 4th, so every April 4th to May 4th we do 100k for Charlie May, where we raise some money by just trying to do 100 kilometers over that month in the build up. It kind of helps us just get to that point in time. It's obviously the build up is tougher than the day in itself, so it helps with that. And then we decided as well that we would set up a charity kind of football match, the Charlie May Memorial Shield, which last year we had our very first. It was actually this weekend last year we had our very first charity match back home, where the men's team at Cahill Harps that I coached back in 2015, 2014-15, came out and played against them, Felicon Father. So for anyone listening, Felicon are a fantastic charity who work with bereaved parents that are going through similar experiences of child loss that myself and Emily would have went through. But they also have a kind of branch off of that, which is Felicon Fathers, which gets dads together to play and train. And it's hard, you know, even when I go into the support groups with Emily, I'm usually the only fella that's on the support groups here in America. So it's hard for men to maybe express their emotions and look at everybody, as I said earlier, everybody grieves differently, and it's just acknowledging that. So having something like Felicon Fathers, where dads can come out, they may not need to necessarily mention their child, but it's something that they can just do to remember and honor their loss, is something that was kind of, it struck me as something that was a real cool concept. So here in Chicago, just this year, I founded the FCFC, so the Fathers of Chicagoland Football Club. At the minute, it's got a member of one, which is me, but hoping over time we can grow it out. Again, I think particularly American men don't want to discuss their emotions too much. So I think it's, once I get a few people out to a training session, I think it'll be a little bit better. But the kind of, the reasoning behind it is, selfishly, every other year, we're going to do the game 1 year in Ireland, 1 year here in the States. So selfishly for me, I want to have a team that will participate in it. But then the kind of de facto part of that is it's going to help dads, you know, it's going to help other dads get through what they're probably grieving and not, they don't have the ability to express it. So so we're hoping this May, I believe, we're hoping to have our first game, hopefully actually on May 4th, because it's a Saturday. So we're either going to go with FCFC as the first game, or we'll do something that it could be some of your old friends at the Pierce's. We might do Team Ireland against Team Rest of the World in it. But as I say, the whole concept is just to bring bereaved dads together and give them an opportunity, as I say, to get together with people who've been through what they've been through. It's not necessarily a support group and where you have to express your emotions, but it's just somewhere that they can remember and honor their loss.
Yeah, I'm very interested in the sense of community and men in particular thriving with their tribes and developing sort of a positive relationship around men getting together, because I don't think necessarily that has always been the case. I don't know how if that's ever appeared in your life in the communities that you've been involved with, and how, you know, they've been a support mechanism for each of you in that case.
Yeah, I think, look, in olden times, and you don't even have to really look back that far, you know, probably even pre-COVID, men didn't express their feelings, you know, and it's always been difficult, or it's seen as a sign of weakness. And I love your little tagline on at the very start of the podcast, where you talk about positive masculinity, where I don't think expressing your emotions should be seen as a negative. I think it's actually quite strong in a society where, especially in today's world, where everything is so divided, but the ability for a man to actually speak up and say, you know, I'm struggling here, it could get them help. Or you could say, I'm struggling, but it might only be for a day. You know what I mean? But just the ability to express yourself and tell people how you're feeling emotionally, I think that's something that we're seeing a kind of a shift that way. There's obviously a bit of resistance on one side. They want all men to be masculine and, you know, men just get on with it. But I mean, if I didn't, from what we went through with Charlie, I mean, every year from December 15th to December 25th, whether I tweet about it, or this year on Instagram, I done Instagram stories, because I done 10Ks, 12 runs at Christmas, so 12 10Ks at Christmas. Every day I kind of talk through what I experienced on that day 3 years ago when we went through everything, and the amount of people that reached out to me and said they went through something similar. So I'm quite proud of the fact that I can do that, but I'm also kind of sad that, like, why can they not talk about their, and I'm not saying they have to, but just that they feel like they can't talk and express how they're feeling in times of trouble and times of grief. I think I struggle with that a little bit still, you know.
Yeah, and I think that's the whole sort of impetus behind this podcast, is try and create that open space and give a movement for men to actually vocalize. It's not saying that we have to be vulnerable all the time. I think there's great strength in men being strong, but strength can be appear in many different ways. And I think, you know, the way you're talking so candidly about the experiences that you've been through is evident of that. Now, obviously, you've done a lot for your own well-being. You're ahead of your time in college, going to see a counsellor. I don't think I would have even dreamed of that when I was a student doing my undergrad. You know, you've taken upon your running. You're very much involved in developing groups that are going to promote the causes that you believe strongly in, so giving yourself a bit of meaning and purpose as well. But what do you think some of the challenges men are facing today with regards to their own well-being?
I still think there is, as I kind of alluded to a few minutes ago, I still think, again, I don't want to make this a political podcast, but I think there's one side of the aisle is very open to men just being a little bit more vulnerable and just letting humans be emotional, right? I try not to differentiate between genders and stuff like that. It's just, on a human level, can we express how we're feeling and not be kind of vilified for it? But then you've got the other side, and I've seen it recently, is people are still saying, like, men should still be allowed to be men, and shouldn't have to express emotions, which, like, I think where I see all that is each to their own, right? So some people want to talk about it, some people don't want to talk about it, and both of those things can be okay at once. So I think that's one of the biggest things that I think society is still, as a whole, probably, as I say, even though it's two sides, but I think society is still kind of ingrained in a way where it's difficult for men to speak about how they're feeling. And again, I use, as I said over the Christmas time, like, I kind of do use my social media platform to express myself a little bit more. And look, sometimes some people you're friends with will say, like, you know, you're soft or give over or whatever. But if it's that one text where I get from that lad who said him and his wife had been through something similar to me and Emily with Charlie. So if that's why I do it, you know what I mean? I don't think people even fully understand why I do it, you know, and why I'll be so open. It helps me, but also if it helps that other person that for whatever reason can't or doesn't feel like speaking up, I think that can only be a good thing. But yeah, I do feel like it's still difficult for men to be more candid and be more open, you know.
Well, I think you're going to be, and you are, great ambassador for it. So I want to thank you for what you're doing. I want to give my regards to your family for what they've been through, but the fact that, you know, they have someone like you promoting it, raising awareness about it, but also just speaking so openly about it, I think is absolutely fantastic. If people want to get in touch with you, Dean, do you have any contact details that you can share?
my Twitter or X or whatever you call it now is Pingu Dean. And then Pingu the Gaffer is my Instagram. But what I like to do, and you know, in the few interviews I've done with this, is Head in the Game. Is the Twitter handle for Head in the Game. You know, if people back home especially would follow that, I think give more of a voice to what we are doing. I'm still heavily involved. I'm not the chairperson of that group anymore, but you know, the lads are doing fantastic work on the ground back home, and it's this year is going to be a big year for it. So follow that. And I think, you know, where I said earlier that's very much based around football, I think it doesn't need to exclude, if anyone's listening to this that is involved with GA and wants to support what the lads are doing, and or get support from the charity partners that we work with, I think, you know, utilize it. It's a service there that we're there to be advocates, not just for the football community. It's everybody, and we're not going to turn anyone away that wants to kind of help and support what we're doing. So if you want to get in touch, as I say, I've got my personal ones, but as I do like to push people towards that Head in the Game. I think it's Head in the Game IE on all social media platforms.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Well, I'll make sure to include them in the descriptions of the podcast and on Instagram at @the_flourishingman. Dean, I want to thank you so much. My best wishes to you, to Fia, to Charlie May and Emily, and everything you do in the future. You've been absolutely fantastic. And I know this is only the start of the movement.
No worries. Thanks very much. I appreciate you having me on.
So once again, I'm going to end today's episode with my 5-minute flourishing. And today's 5-minute flourishing, we are going to discuss the topic of connection. But first, a story. In West Pennsylvania, about 2 hours straight north of Philadelphia in the United States, lies the humble community of Rosetto. In the 1960s, a study was carried out there amongst the Italian immigrant community, producing results that stunned medical experts. Embracing their Italian heritage, the people of Rosetto enjoyed many of the things that you would expect. Good food, good drink, and good families. Community, though, was at the heart of their daily lives, with multiple generations living under the same roof. What was most remarkable about the town was that death rates due to heart attacks and strokes were substantially lower than in other neighboring towns. The study concluded that there was a correlation between healthier Rosetto residents and their greater relationships. As a species, we long for high-quality connections. Our ancestors, well, they hunted together, shared food together, and fought off enemies together. We are primed to relate because those who attached tended to survive. However, in the last 40 years, studies have shown that we are amid a loneliness epidemic, with one 2019 report claiming that nearly 8 out of 10 Gen Zers and 7 out of 10 millennials are lonely compared to half of the boomer generation. All evidence points to the catastrophic consequences of such loneliness. While many studies have shown that connection can be great for our health, it is now widely accepted that social isolation can increase our risks of death as much as smoking cigarettes and even more than physical inactivity. Within this ongoing loneliness epidemic, there is another critical issue that demands our attention, and that is the silent battle of male loneliness. According to research, the number of close friendships among men has been decreasing in recent years. In 2021, 15% of men reporting having no close friends compared to only 3% in 1990. Additionally, a survey conducted by the Pew Research Center in 2022 revealed that 60% of young men are single, which is nearly double the rate of single women. For me personally, I always reflect on how grateful I am for the families and friends that I have in my life and the deep connections I've been able to foster with them. At my lowest points, as well as my best moments, they have always been there for me when I needed it. They have offered me everything from an outlet for my frustrations to a place to stay when I was stuck. What makes the people in my life extra special is that they are always making an effort. They are always texting, calling, organizing opportunities for us to get together and savor the deep connections that we have managed to cultivate with each other. I will always be grateful for them. My flourishing thought today is to know that if you are feeling lonely, there are ways out there to combat it. Number one is connecting with others. If you're new to a place or struggling to find those connections, try joining a club or a sports group. I guarantee there are men out there with whom you share a common ground. And don't forget, we are also living in a digital age. I know of girls who have used online platforms, usually reserved for finding romantic partners, to make genuine friendships that with similarly open-minded women.
As men, we've got to be open to doing the same. Remember, one path is never the only path to take. Finally, don't forget to look after yourself. Both your mental and physical well-being should be a priority. Try doing small things that rejuvenate you, be it exercise, better sleep, and eating well. These things play a significant role in maintaining emotional balance and ultimately will help reduce feelings of loneliness. In closing, remember that loneliness is a universal human experience, and seeking connection is key to overcoming it. Whether you're reaching out to old friends or joining a new community, know that you are not alone in this journey. By prioritizing connection and taking proactive steps to nurture meaningful relationships, you can cultivate a sense of belonging and well-being in your life. And don't forget, you can also be the power broker in ending loneliness by reaching out to a mate and seeing if they need someone. We are all stakeholders in making the world a better place, and building a community can start with you. Once again, thank you for joining me today. I want to just say that I was absolutely blown away by the feedback I got from episode one. The kind words and messages I received from each and every one of you who are listening today, it was absolutely humbling, and I really am inspired to continue this work with promoting male well-being. So thank you very much. And if you are out there listening and you feel like you have something to offer, please reach out to me. My Instagram is a bit of a tongue twister, but it's @_flourishingman. Until next time though, remember, I love you, man.